Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. This week, we'll talk about all things water, water quality, water management, and the apparently rising waters of the earth. First, though, we talk with a man who's fighting an effort by the state legislature to do away with the Des Moines Water Works. Lawmakers have been debating a bill that would essentially dismantle that organization. Bill Stowe is the CEO of the Des Moines Water Works. Stowe says the bill is a reaction to the lawsuit his organization filed against Buena Vista, Calhoun, and Sac counties, alleging that those counties have allowed high nitrate levels to more quickly seep from farm fields into the Raccoon River and from there into the drinking water.
Essentially, Des Moines Water Works has been a municipal utility for nearly 100 years. By municipal utility, it means that we are a public water provider, but we're independent from the city of Des Moines. What this legislation initially said is that it would dismember, disband the Des Moines Water Works and have the city be an interim manager, as we were forced into a contrived regional water utility. Now that's fallen out entirely. Actually, the bill, which Jared Klein, the original sponsor, said centered entirely on regional water, now no longer has the term regional or region in it. So they've kind of run for cover from their original story to something now that we only understand to mean that the city of Des Moines would essentially take our assets, and that's $250 or $300 million worth of assets, significant number of assets, but no discussion about regionalism at all. So from our vantage, obviously this is very much a concern for us because it scraps a 100-year process of having water boards like ours and like one in Urbandale and West Des Moines who are structured to be independent from city governments now, co-opted by city governments. Huge issue for us, and in our view, it smells and feels and tastes, no pun intended, a lot like Flint, Michigan, where the state government reached into a city water provider and ended up creating a whole daisy chain of events that ended up with lead contamination in the public water system within Flint, Michigan, with huge public health risks. And certainly the exact thing would not happen here, but the idea of people who are by their nature kept out of this business now encroaching in our business and creating a daisy chain of events is of great concern to us and should be of a great concern to all Iowans, because this state overreach is something that has significant public health risks.
Why do you think it's so important for the people behind this bill to see this happen?
Well, the Des Moines Register has done a really good job of, you know, kind of running this down over not only this session, but in the prior session. They were similar attempts from the same sponsor, in this case, Jared Klein. Jared is a pig farmer from Washington County, Iowa, which, as you probably know, is 100 miles or so away from us. Certainly has nothing to do with our customers or our service territory or even our water sources. It's clear that this is an attempt to shift control to the city of Des Moines and to kill our clean water lawsuit. And that is obviously a huge issue for us. And it isn't in keeping with how Iowans do business, even with those who we disagree with. We don't obliterate their system of governance just because we disagree with them. So we very much reject the underlying thought here, and the method of doing it is so haphazard that we're concerned for economic reasons for our ratepayers, but also for very practical reasons for public health consequences. We're not selling strawberry ice cream that you or I can choose to avoid. We're selling safe drinking water to 500,000 folks. So clearly that's something that's beyond aesthetic. That's life sustaining.
I heard some people at the hearing the other night say this is about revenge for that lawsuit.
We certainly think it is. The Farm Bureau, we believe, is very much an active party in the sponsorship of this and kind of clandestine support. Ultimately, our clean water lawsuit will move forward. This is a circumstance, I think, where you can shoot the messenger but not kill the message. Our message of source water protection, protecting the surface waters of this state in particular from industrial agriculture, will live beyond Des Moines Water Works if we're unsuccessful in fighting this We look forward to continuing to pursue what we think is in our ratepayers' best interest, and that's better protecting the environment in this state, particularly water quality in this state. Clearly, we have some enemies, and they're attempting to overreach through state government to get at us and our theory of environmental protection in this state. But we're going to resist that with every lawful method we have available to us.
What do you think will happen there? What kind of a conversation do you see occurring there?
Well, I'm not sure conversation is necessarily in keeping with the tone of whatever debate happens. I'm fairly confident we'll be revealing about different sides of an environmental issue. Certainly anyone who tries to believe that state government should be involved in local government issues like water systems is hiding behind something with the idea of getting even for some grudge against local government. Whether we're talking about Sioux City or Council Bluffs or Des Moines or wherever it may be in between, local governments are very accountable, and certainly we view the ineptitude of this overreach to be something that we're going to continue to push back on. I'm confident the debate and discussions in the House and the Iowa Senate will reveal a great deal about things other than regional water systems or local water systems, because the folks who are debating it understand very little about either. The real issue here is where Iowa's going in terms of its future of protecting its source waters and accommodating an interest we all have in agriculture success.
I wonder if this particular issue for some people is somewhat complex. Maybe they don't know all the backstory of it, especially if they're not around the Des Moines area and they hear it and they say, oh, well, why not get rid of the Des Moines Water Works? Why do you need the Des Moines Water Works, right? They think, oh, well, you know, save some money, take it into the local government.
Well, in fact, taking it into the local government won't save any money. It'll cost a lot of money because we are separate from local government, local city government, with the idea that our ratepayers' rates, water rates, are segregated and used to invest back in the system. We believe that if the city is successful in taking over our system, that they will use our rates and considerable assets really for other uses, whether it's parks or whether it's pothole repair or whatever it may be. It certainly isn't dedicated as we are to safe drinking water. So we believe that ultimately this creates risks for public safety, but will also cost our ratepayers money in diverting our assets to things that really are not about safe drinking water, as the rates folks pay should be directly centered on protecting.
I can definitely see how you would be a very tempting asset to be taking over, because you're in such a financially very good situation.
No question, in Iowa, cities are threatened by their own lack of revenue, and utilities, whether it's a water utility or a sewer utility, solid waste utility, telecommunications, gas, electric, whatever it may be, are by their very nature have a lot of cash flow, a lot going on, and a lot of incoming revenue. Very tempting for cities to be able to try and appropriate that, take it over, if you will. But ultimately, that'll have a consequence to the ratepayers. We're very much sole functioned around safe drinking water. We're not collecting money for the city's benefit to do other things. Certainly, they have a broader sense of concerns than safe drinking water, but we think that's actually a diversion from where their attention should be. And their attention should be on police and fire service, things that they do. Let us attend to providing safe drinking water. Don't come in and raid our money. Don't interfere in our decisions to make independent decisions from the city. We believe that ultimately that'll be to the detriment of certainly our customers, but ultimately it's also setting us on a course here in Iowa to get rid of independent governments that need some arm's length from city governments. Otherwise, they just become another city department and easily manipulated by local politics.
What would happen then if this bill is approved and the governor signs it? Do you have any recourse?
Certainly, there's, you know, fortunately, we live in a system that has lots of recourses and lots of checks and balances in the event that in anything like its current form, this law would pass, we'll be looking at our legal options. We certainly hope not to be in that position because we hope reason will come into play. We know there are a number of legislators, Republicans and Democrats, who view this as state overreach. And we're hoping that they'll step forward in legislative debate and in votes to protect the interests of Des Moines Waterworks and local independent governments. If unfortunately that does not work, then we'll be looking at our options, which among other things do include legal challenge.
This has gotten a lot of coverage, not just in the state, but nationally too. Do you think that this is really resonating with people on the national level because this is a concern that every city has, every county has?
Well, I think we're learning environmental protection, whether it's air and water quality or any kind of public health dimension, is something that all of us value, many of us as Americans have taken for granted. As time goes on, good air quality, good water quality become extraordinarily difficult to protect because there are competing resources that challenge environmental protection or conservation. I am confident as we read about Flint, Michigan, or hear about Flint, Michigan, or water shortage issues here in the United States or within our own state or internationally, that these issues are ones we remember and can come back to, because if you've ever been thirsty or if you've ever been hungry or you've ever suffered from asthma, you certainly can have an appreciation for what scarce, necessary resources mean to us as biological creatures. So I think this resonates. I think what really resonates in our particular case is a clear overreach. This local government issue has come up through state government, through the agricultural committees. Clearly has nothing to do at all with good government or good governance and regulating local governance. This is an overreach. And I think people have a unique sense of understanding and appreciation for governments that overreach. We're spending a lot of time, and you've mentioned a lot of media attention on this issue. The real focus should be on preserving and protecting Iowa's water quality. Last year, Governor Branstad talked about the biggest, boldest initiative he would have to protect water quality. Clearly, nothing has gone forward of any meaningful sense about that, and we as Iowans should be very concerned that instead of spending resources trying to dismember Des Moines Waterworks or any local government entity that some powerful interests may have disagreements with, we should be focusing on public health issues, on environmental protection and economic development, and preserving and protecting a very scarce resource we have, and that's safe water.
That was Bill Stowe, the CEO of the Des Moines Waterworks. State lawmakers are still debating a bill that would dismantle the organization after a lot of opposition from citizens and citizen groups who are worried about the possible effect the move might have on water quality in central Iowa. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Keeping nutrients and agricultural runoff out of Iowa's lakes, streams, and drinking water has been an ongoing problem. While the growth of algae has often been seen as a nuisance, a pair of Iowa State University researchers are turning it into a tool to clean our water. The process improves the efficiency of wastewater reclamation using that algae. It's gotten the attention of small Iowa communities and the largest wastewater treatment system in the world. Gio Wen is an ISU professor of food science and human nutrition. He developed the system with Martin Gross, an ISU postdoctoral fellow in the Center for Crops Utilization Research in Ames, Iowa. Martin Gross says the system is especially helpful in small rural Iowa towns that use lagoons for water treatment and have big ammonia problems that can become very expensive when the towns try to meet EPA standards.
So this is kind of our target market right now, is ammonia removal at lagoons. Because there's such a problem, and the current options for ammonia removal in lagoons are really expensive. For example, we're working with the city of Dallas Center, and their current nutrient removal or ammonia removal, so they're getting a new ammonia permits by the Iowa DNR, and they're going to have to spend anywhere from $5.5 million to $2.5 million to treat their ammonia using their lagoons. And we believe that our system can be implemented at a fraction of that cost and save these small communities a lot of money to meet their new permits. Along with our process, in addition to the water treatment, we're producing algae biomass as well. So maybe not to make biofuels, but we've actually looked into we developed a process to pelletize our algae and make a slow release algae-based fertilizer out of the wastewater. So really what we're doing, it's not just nitrogen removal, it's nitrogen recovery during the process. So the algae is growing on the wastewater, which needs the nitrogen removed from. When the algae grows, it takes in the nitrogen. And then when we actually harvest that algae from the system, we are removing that nitrogen in the biomass, and then we can actually reuse that nitrogen for agricultural purposes for a fertilizer. Really, we developed the technology at Iowa State, and then the entity that's commercializing it's Gross One Technologies, which Gio and I founded several years ago. So we're trying to commercialize it through our company, Gross One Technologies.
So this really is a win-win because it's good for the environment. You create something that's valuable and needed.
That's exactly right. You know, in Iowa, we produce a lot of biofuels from corn and soybeans, which those are competing with our food crops. You know, so instead of making food out of corn, we're making biofuels, which there's a lot of debate around whether that's what we should be doing. Algae, on the other hand, you actually aren't disrupting the food cycle. You could grow algae in the middle of the desert to make biofuels out of. So that's really what got me interested in algae in the first place. And then now that we can actually use the algae to treat wastewater, which is another huge issue. You know, there's the food versus fuel debate, but there's also the water scarcity and the water pollution concerns that are around that algae also can address. So although we didn't originally think about using algae for water treatment, it's a kind of an added benefit of the system that it's able to do that as well.
How much would it take for you to be able to sort of go wide with this and make it available to many more cities?
What we're doing right now is we have a pilot project in Dallas Center, which is our high importance project where we're treating lagoon wastewater. And what we're doing is collecting data in that pilot study so we could go to the Iowa DNR, which is the regulatory agency in Iowa, to go through the approval process for new technologies. So the DNR doesn't want companies coming and selling technologies in the state that aren't proven. So we have to collect a lot of data to prove it to the Iowa DNR so they can say, yeah, Dallas Center, you can use the technology. We approve that. So that's our big hurdle right now. Once we get through that DNR approval process, we envision several communities throughout the state to actually adopt the system. We actually anticipate building our first full-scale system this summer in Dallas Center if we can get that DNR approval process to go through smoothly.
I was looking at some of the pictures and the green and the rolls and it's running and then what comes out of it. It's really amazing how that works.
You know, our innovation is really the algae growth system. We call it the revolving algal biofilm treatment system or the RAB system. So conventionally, algae is grown in something called a raceway pond or photobioreactors. So you could think of algae as a microscopic single-celled plant. And in these other systems, these cells are just floating around in the liquid. And in our system, the algae is actually attached on the surface of these belts. And what this means is, in comparison to these conventional systems where there's algae suspended, the biggest problem in those systems is how do you harvest the algae out of those systems? You have to take microscopic cells floating around the liquid and separate them from water, which tends to be the biggest cost and the biggest hurdle. In our system, we grow algae attached on the belts on something called a biofilm, and the algae can actually be harvested very cost-effectively and separated from the water. So that's really our innovation. So if there's one thing that we have is what I would say the best way to grow algae in the market today. And then we're just applying that system to wastewater treatment. So the way that we developed this system is I'm in Iowa, you know, I came from Iowa, a small town, and there's, you know, numerous farm ponds throughout the state. And if you walk around the farm pond, you'll see algae growing on rocks and, you know, attached on surfaces anyway. So I kind of took the way that algae naturally likes to grow in this like biofilm form and applied it to an industrial level to grow algae in that kind of nature, because it's easy to harvest in that form.
Gio, you're originally from China. Was this problem something you were familiar with before you came to the United States and to Iowa?
Since I came to the United States in 2001, I was in a different small towns from West Coast, Washington State, to East Coast, Virginia, and right now in Midwest. So I was pretty amazed to see the U.S. agriculture and the rural area. And this algae thing, you know, I've been working on algae for quite a long time, since I was a PhD student, about almost 20 years ago. And so, as Martin said, that time I was not focusing on the wastewater treatment for, you know, particularly for rural area, small town. I was focusing on the algae production for fuel. And then about 2010, when I moved to Iowa State, Martin, that time he was just an undergraduate student. So he just one day stopped by at my office. I heard, Dr. Wen, I heard you are working on algae. I want to work with algae. So at that time, you know, he's just an undergraduate student. So I decided to hire him, you know, do some kind of lab assistant work. But with the time evolves, and I can tell Martin get more and more interested in his algae research. So then later on, he became my master's student and a PhD student. You know, this kind of technology evolved. Yes, this technology is co-invented by us, but I would give the majority of the credit to Martin.
It sounds like right around Iowa State, Ames, Story County, that there is a real push for developing innovative technologies. Now, it sort of reminds me a little bit of Research Triangle Park out in North Carolina. This thing has become quite an incubator for new technologies, hasn't it?
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah. Actually, our president, Iowa State University president, Stephen Lees, actually, he moved from Triangle area. He used to be a vice president in University of North Carolina system. So he's very familiar with how to develop a commercial technology from the university research. So he bring this whole concept, whole mentality to Iowa State.
There's been a lot of technologies developed at Iowa State, but there really hasn't been a lot of mentoring for the scientists like myself and Dr. Wen to commercialize these systems. So recently there's, Dr. Wen mentioned that's the startup factory, which is headed by Bill Adamowski, which is really a mentoring process to help engineers and scientists that develop technologies at a university try to take those technologies and make them a viable business. So that's the startup factory that was just founded this past year. There's also another program called the Ag Startup Engine, which is part of the Ag College. That's a spinoff from the Ag College, which is also kind of a mentoring program to help companies like ours really develop a business. Because if we're going to be successful, we can have the best technology available. But without the business side of things present, we really would never take off. So these two new programs that have been developed at Iowa State have been really instrumental in pushing us along.
That was Gio Wen and Martin Gross, Iowa State University researchers. They're the creators of the algae reclamation system at Iowa State University in Ames. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett.
Thank you.
photographer, sailor, environmental activist, and educator. These are just some of the titles David Thoreson has acquired during his long career. He grew up, though, in Iowa, in Algona and Okoboji. Thoreson is the author of several books of photography, videos about his travels from Antarctica to the Northwest Passage, and much more. He'll be speaking to the Northwest Iowa Sierra Club on March 20th. Thoreson says people are always surprised when he tells them he got his start in ocean sailing through a friendship with a hog farmer in Minnesota.
Yeah, it's not so funny in Iowa because people kind of understand it more, but when I go speak around the country and I say that I'm a sailor from Iowa and that I got my pathway to the ocean from a southern Minnesota hog farmer, people go crazy. But, you know, we kind of get that in Iowa, that we're sort of people that are from the land in small towns, and agribusiness is a huge part of living in the Midwest. And so, and we have all these little lakes scattered in northern Iowa and southern Minnesota into Wisconsin. So there's a lot of sailors. And we all have this Norwegian or Scandinavian background, and many of us anyway. So we came from backgrounds with water and found these lakes and settled around lakes and still enjoy the water so much. And I happened to hook up with a southern Minnesota hog farmer who was sailing the world. And that's why I went off sailing with to so many of these places.
You had some amazing video that was part of a presentation you did, one of your TED Talks, I believe. I don't know if it had to do with the Northwest Passage, but how you came upon a shore and it had the gravestones of previous explorers.
Yes, that was the Sir John Franklin expedition, and that was in the Canadian Arctic of the Northwest Passage. And that was an expedition in 1845-46, where all 129 men would later die on the two British vessels. But the first three crew members died that winter that they froze into the ice. And as I always say, they were the lucky ones, because over the next couple of years, when they were trapped, frozen in the ice and had lead poisoning, that must have been a horrific set of circumstances that they had to face there in the Arctic. But the demise of that expedition led to other people coming to search for what happened to Sir John Franklin and all of his men. So it culminated in the discovery of the Northwest Passage.
Did it freak you out a little bit to see that?
You know, what it really did was it made it real. You know, it's you read all the history, and anybody who's a history buff will understand this, that when you go to the actual place that you've read about, all of a sudden that history comes alive. And so the gravity of the history and what we were facing ourselves and the potential peril became very real, to see that kind of death right in front of you. And then, you know, the story to boot. So at the time in the early 1990s, when we were there, there wasn't any satellite communication. We didn't have any cell phones or anything like that. Heck, we didn't even have laptop computers or internet or anything like that at the time. So it was still kind of an old school expedition, and we were really up there alone in the elements.
I know that part of your work also has to do with educating kids, and you've done some curriculum that anyone can use in schools.
I decided that I really wanted to get involved more with education and science, and I connected with scientists and educators and sailors that wanted to sail around the Americas and work on an ocean and sea awareness program. So the neat thing about this was I got to collaborate with so many different people. So I had my own ideas to bring to the table of what I was mostly interested in, and then the other sailors, scientists, educators put their heads together, and out of these ideas, there became a curriculum designed by the Pacific Science Center in Seattle. And it was based on plugging into kids in the K-8 ranges in age. And kids don't really get oceanography these days in their science courses. So what we wanted to try to do was inject some science into regular science, oceanography into regular science curriculum so that kids could learn more about the oceans and seas and what are some of the potential issues out there like overfishing and ocean acidification, some of these things.
Have you got any feedback about how it's being used and how it's working?
Oh, it's still being used. In fact, that's part of the reason that the website is all still up from the Around the Americas, because the issues of the ocean haven't gone away. So this curriculum, everything in it is still relevant. The only thing that I would add now to this curriculum would be the gyres of the oceans and what's going on with this plastic pollution in these gyres, and especially in what's called the North Pacific Garbage Patch, which a lot of people are looking at now. But it's still part of the Pacific Science Center out in Seattle. I know that they still use a lot, and also the Sailors for the Sea, which is David Rockefeller's nonprofit organization that we started with our Voyage Around the Americas. So it's had quite a big spinoff on both coasts.
So what's a gyre?
A gyre is this collection point in the major oceans of the world where ocean currents converge. And it's interesting that, you know, in the oceans, you can't really see the heat and cold transport through the oceans in these ocean currents, but you can certainly see plastic garbage. And what's happened is that these ocean gyres, these collections of ocean currents, have now started collecting our debris from the last 50 years. And there's five major gyres that are formed in the oceans, two in the Pacific, two in the Atlantic, one in the Indian Ocean, and all of them have plastic garbage that's been collecting over the last 50 years or so.
So what happens with that huge pile of plastic?
Well, the plastics get pulverized. We tend to think of the plastics as great big things like tarps and tennis shoes and rubber duckies and these sorts of things. Some of them fall off container ships. Others are just from areas like plastic water bottles where they don't have recycling programs and they just get thrown in the ocean, one and done kind of use. And they get broken up slowly over time, and they turn into little plastic, either microbeads or small pellets, and they're suspended, unfortunately, in the water column all the way down to over 30,000 feet deep in the ocean. So there are a lot of ocean species, mammals and birds, that collect these plastics as just part of their feeding cycle. And so these plastics are penetrating the majority of marine life, unfortunately, now in the North Pacific. It's a huge problem. There's some breeding grounds out there with albatross, for instance, where there's over a million birds, and 90% of them have plastic penetration either on or in their bodies.
Does that kill them eventually?
Many of them it does. And especially things like the plastic grocery bags, which is part of the reason why they're banned in so many coastal communities now, because species like sea turtles will be swimming along and they'll see one of these plastic grocery bags sort of pulsing in the ocean, and it looks like a jellyfish, which is just a yummy snack for a sea turtle. And they'll try to eat this garbage bag or grocery bag, and it'll get wrapped all over their face and down their neck, and eventually they'll die from malnourishment or suffocation.
Now, I had heard stories about the garbage bags and how they affected wildlife, but that is a very graphic depiction. It's very sad.
It is very sad. As part of my exhibit, and when I speak to schools, I actually take various plastics sort of exhibits and demonstrations out there. One of them is when my wife stitched together almost 300 plastic water bottles to kind of symbolize the average use of an American over the course of 1 year. And I put them in a big black plastic bag so the kids can't see what's in there. And I'll ask for someone to help, and they'll pull the string out. And then I'll need another student and another. And before you know it, this string goes all the way around the auditorium or gymnasium. And it's a really good visual way for us to kind of see how much we're contributing to the environment.
That was David Thorson, a world-renowned photographer, explorer, sailor, and environmentalist. He'll be in town next Monday to talk to the Northwest Iowa Sierra Club. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. David Thorson is one example of an Iowan who's made a name for himself in photography, travel, and the environmental worlds. Brad Carl is a Sioux City native who is becoming a popular writer of mystery novels. His first book is called Gray Areas. It's the first of four books in a series. Carl says he loved writing in high school. After college, he began his career in broadcasting at KG95 in Sioux City. He then moved on to Kansas City 20 years ago, and worked in other areas until he caught the writing bug once again.
I was inspired by a book that I read that really just kind of laid out self-publishing. And I thought, man, I can do this. This is not rocket science. It's a great combination of art and business and marketing. And the business and marketing thing was something that I've been studying for, the last 20 years since I'd been in Kansas City, and so the writing part I thought was going to be the fun part, and that's kind of where it all started, I guess. I read a book that inspired me, and the rest is the last 2 years is history, so to speak, I guess.
How did you decide to write mysteries in particular?
Well, my oldest memory of reading a chapter book around the age of 7 or 8. Was the classic Hardy Boys mystery book series. And that was really what inspired me as a kid to want to enjoy reading, number one, and also writing. I as a kid, I did it myself. I would write little books at the age of 8 or 9. They were really short, like 4 or 5 pages. You'd fold them and staple them, and you draw a little cover and stuff like that. And mysteries were always, something that inspired me. And then also really television shows here over the last 15 years, if you've been paying attention at all, you've noticed that they've changed in many ways. I mean, obviously now there's a lot of cable networks producing, 6, 7, 8 season very intriguing type psychological thrillers that have huge cliffhangers at the end of seasons or at the end of episodes and make you wait another week to find out what happens and things like that. And TV shows like Justified and The Sopranos and Breaking Bad really inspired me as I started writing, because I really thought there was something there to these long but not boring stories that had to do with people that were very troubled in a lot of ways, but also people that we could relate to as normal, everyday people. It was very, very intriguing, I guess, to me. And so that's kind of what I set out to do with my first book series was to draw from my past and my experience in life and create something very similar. And I think I may have succeeded in that, because I've certainly had a number of people say that they really enjoy that first book series, Gray Areas, they think that it could be a TV show or a movie or something like that, which is very flattering to hear, because I think that's really what I set out to do, was to put something like that on paper.
In your first book, the character Henry Fields, he's somebody you sort of gradually introduce him. It is a very, I like how you do it, because you get an idea of what this guy's like, but you don't learn everything about him in the first 20 pages. And I think mm-hmm. that is often something that will go wrong in books, even mystery books.
One of the things that I wanted to show in that first book was you know, the car accident that happened where, you know, Henry helps out. And I wanted to show that Henry obviously has some good in him, and that he's not, you know, necessarily this other person that at the end of the book you start to question with the cliffhanger at the end. Okay, what's really going on with this guy, and why is he here? You know, and the other thing that I try to do with it too is to surround him with people that are curious about him, and also his nature, to not tell much about his past, but also find him likable as well. And you know, I tried to make him and everybody around him relatable, and I hope that worked in that regard. Although, as I've found out from a few people who read it, they were frustrated with the cliffhanger at the end of the first book, and apparently they didn't see like the end of The Empire Strikes Back, you know, stuff like that. You know?
Well, that was successful.
Right, exactly.
Why not?
Exactly.
Well, you know, one thing I like about him is he's likable, but he also is extremely calculating. He says, "Well, should I try and get the guy to pay me cash? How much should I?" He gives the waitress how he pays the waitress, how he decides when to show up to work, where he's going to live. Is he going to live in the smaller town? Is he going to live in the bigger area? He's very mentally astute and calculating in everything that he does.
Yes, absolutely. And that was certainly something that I intentionally did. I remember specifically making notes about his awareness. And a lot of times what you have to do, I think, as a writer, is put yourself in the position of every character. You know, whether it's Henry, whether it's Claire, whether it's Sergeant Jackson. You know, you have to try to think to yourself, what would I do if I was in this situation? And of course, as the author and the dangler of all the puppets in this, I know what you don't know when you're reading the first book. I know who Henry Fields is. I know what he's been through. So I can try to use that in a way that is leading you as the reader, but at the same time, not giving it all away, because I want to have that big huzzah moment at the end of the first book, I guess. So yeah, that was definitely intentional. And yeah, it was enjoyable to write that particular first book because of that.
Recently, I was looking at another mystery quasi, I don't know if it was horrific at the end, but it's meant to be some kind of a horror genre too. And in some ways it was similar to your setting in a smaller town, and people working in very typical sorts of jobs, maybe at a video store, at a convenience store, living their lives. And I wonder if there isn't something, people being interested in books about Iowa, because I think now there used to be a feeling, well, this is a boring place to be, but I think now people, there's sort of an interest in it, in that on the surface, it's all very, very nice, but it's almost sort of, you know, digging underneath and finding all these different intricacies in the lives of people here, and that they're not just here because they have nowhere else to go.
You know, I grew up not necessarily in a small town, being Sioux City, but my mother and father both grew up in small towns in Iowa. And I've always been very, very intrigued by just, you know, driving into or driving through or hanging out, you know, in a small town, just to kind of get a feel for the vibe. There's, you know, the one diner and bar or whatever. There's the convenience store on the corner. And you're right. There's people are there for certain reasons that are not necessarily reasons that you might think. And then, of course, as you peel back all the layers, you never really know what's going on behind the scenes there. And I was a little bit nervous about having rough things going on in a small town in Iowa. I didn't want to catch any flack, but I have not really caught, you know, any grief for that. I think that people in general are realistic and know that, frankly, sometimes things do happen in small towns, whether it's in Iowa or a perfect example is this Friday night I was out with some friends and family, and we were talking about what is generally a pretty famous story about a place called Skidmore, Missouri, that there's a book called In Broad Daylight, I believe is what it's called. And I haven't actually read the book yet, but I've heard the story, and I don't want to give it away. But it's a perfect example of exactly what, you know, we're talking about here, Mary, about things, you know, small towns that look one way, and sometimes there's things going on right under your nose, maybe because of the innocence that's on the surface of a small town.
I think people now see Iowa as a place with more going on than just caucuses or corn or, you know, a place where everyone's so nice and you can go. It's a place in the middle of the country that seems to have a little bit of the rest of the country in it, in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. You know, I think you're right. There's a stereotype, I guess, for lack of a better term, but I think it's starting to come around. I think that in general, our country in many ways is starting to come around when it comes to stuff like that. And another thing that is really intriguing about small towns and what I love about small towns in Iowa, for example, is kind of the history and the stories that you might hear. And I think there's a couple of them that are actually, you know, put in gray areas that are just, they kind of give that background to show that, you know, there's a story behind everything. I think Stubby is a perfect example of Stubby's Diner in Gable, Iowa, my fictitious town where Henry Fields drives through and makes his home. You know, there's a couple of stories there. There's one story that's told in the first book, and there's another story that's maybe a little bit darker later on, I think, in the second book. And, you know, but I think you're right. I think that Iowa is, I think people are starting to realize that there's more to it. I like your mention of caucuses and things like that. You're absolutely right.
That was Brad Carl, a Sioux City native who is now a writer of mystery novels. The first one is called Gray Areas. He now lives in Kansas City. That's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. Next week, we'll catch up with what's going on at state legislatures in Iowa and Nebraska. We'll also take a look at an effort to create an historic district in downtown Sioux City. That's next Wednesday at noon here on Siouxland Public Media. Thanks today to Allie Carson, Steve Smith, Mark Munger, and Rick Turner. I'm Mary Hartnett. Thanks for listening.